Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for coming. I think we're going to get started. Really appreciate everybody turning out for this great panel. And wanted to, if you haven't been welcomed already, welcome everybody to the Bay Area Book Festival program generally and to the Writing Climate, this Writing Climate event. I'm really excited to speak to each of the three people on this panel. And before I introduce them, I just want to say that I'm David Wallace Wells. I'll be leading the conversation, but I'm also hoping that we have a kind of dynamic back and forth and that we open it up to you relatively quickly. So hopefully we'll have about a half hour or so for audience Q&A, and I imagine there'll be some interesting things to talk about there. Starting all the way on my left, that is Charlie Jane Anders, the author of All Birds in the Sky, which won a Nebula Award.
Oh. Thank you. Wow.
Her next novel is The City in the Middle of the Night, due out in early 2019, which I'm thrilled to have read recently in preparation for this panel. Her story, 6 Months, 3 Days, won a Hugo Award and appears in a new short story collection called 6 Months, 3 Days, 5 Others. Her short fiction has appeared in Tor.com, Wired Magazine, Slate, Tin House, Conjunction, Boston Review, Asimov's Science Fiction, The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, McSweeney's Internet Tendencies, Zizova, and several anthologies. you got some fans. She was a founding editor of IO9, a site about science fiction, science, and futurism, and she organizes the monthly Writers with Drinks reading series. Her first novel... Her first novel, Choir Boy, won a Lambda Literary Award. So, Charlie Jane Anders. Brenda Shaughnessy was born in Okinawa, Japan, grew up in Southern California. She's the author of 4 books of poetry, including So Much Synth, Human Dark with Sugar, which is the winner of the James Laughlin Award and finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. And Our Andromeda, which was listed by the New York Times Book Review in its 100 Notable Books of 2013. She is an assistant professor of English at Rutgers in Newark, New Jersey, and her new book of poems, which we'll be talking a little bit about today, is The Octopus Museum. Brenda Shaughnessy. Woo! Kai Emmons is the author of the novels His Mother's Son and The Stylist. Her newest novel, Weather Woman, is about a meteorologist who discovers she has the power to change the weather. And she just told me that she has recently sold a sequel, which I've already forgotten the name of. But
Sinking Island.
Sinking Island. Kai's story collection, Vanishing, winner of the 2018 Leapfrog Press Fiction Contest, will be published this fall. Formerly a playwright and screenwriter, her short work has appeared in such publications as Tri-Quarterly, Narrative, and Arts and Culture, among others. She holds degrees from Yale University, NYU, and the University of Oregon, and has taught creative writing and film at the University of Oregon, the University of Southern California, UCLA, and Orange Coast College. So, Kai Emmons. So I wanted to start actually by asking just each of you, this is a panel which is called or subtitled Literature of the Anthropocene, and I wanted to ask each of you, maybe starting with you, Kai, how you see the subject of the Anthropocene and how you came to it as a subject. Maybe then we can just go back down the panel.
Well, I have always been interested in climate, in the climate since we began to hear news that it was changing. What brought me to the subject in terms of this particular novel is that I've always been interested in weather. I grew up in New England, and the New England weather is known for changing on a dime. And that was true. You know, I remember some of my favorite events of my childhood were when we had blizzards of 2 feet deep and we stayed home from school, or we would go up to the attic of the house and watch hurricanes swaying the trees. And it was exciting. I mean, it was better than a good movie, you know. It was entertainment. You know, it wasn't something you thought could damage people or hurt people in any significant way. So when I came to the writing of this particular novel, I was really first interested in weather. But as David says, you can't write about weather without eventually coming to climate. And I think one of the things that I came to understand is that when we write fiction these days, as David says so eloquently in his book, The Uninhabitable Earth, we are always writing from within a changing climate. We are not writing about a changing climate that is out there, but it's happening to us as we write. I guess, I don't know if I'm really answering your question, but weather drew me and weather becomes climate and... You know.
Well, I'm curious to talk later a little bit about you know how something like weather, which has played such a role as a kind of parable, a source of mystical meaning throughout narrative history, can be used and seen as something that we have more control of, and how that affects our storytelling about it. But before we get to that, Brenda, do you want to maybe talk a little bit about how you came to the Anthropocene as a subject?
I mean, just super duper fear. I'm so scared. I thought, why did I have children? What was wrong with me? We're going to, this is, come on. But I think also too, I've worked a lot with, and I've thought a lot about the way that dualisms, binaries work in our culture, and how they really always just divide and literally conquer, right? You have, whenever you divide you divide a whole into two, one's on top, one's on the bottom. And, you know, as somebody who's really trying to puzzle out what does it mean to be someone who's like biracial in this world? What does it mean to be bisexual? What does it mean to sort of have a couple different identities all, and the term is intersectionality, but I think intersection is weird because it's like, it implies crossroads. Well, it's actually much more fluid than that. You know, no one's like, we're not at crossroads. We're not automatically, you know, in this sort of formation. That fluidity in identities, that there's a mixing of not just peoples, but a mixing of identities and perspectives and sort of lands, nations, that just the sort of way that any one person has a multiple set of identities and perspectives. And I believe in that, and I'm always puzzling through that in my poetry, because it seems to me like what happens with the Anthropocene, with human beings' understanding of ourselves, is that it's like humans over here and everything else over here. Right. You know, that there's like, we're on top, and they're on the bottom, meaning like all the trees, all the animals, all the oceans, everything. It's just sort of, you know, separate and definitely not equal. And so to me, it's an extension of all of those questions that I've always had, but it seems quite urgent and I can't sleep at night.
I used to work on this website called IO9, and we had a lot of science coverage as well as science fiction. And what we learned through trial and error was that if we mentioned climate change in the headline of any of our articles, nobody would want to read that article, and that there's a real difficulty in getting people to think about climate change. People have a lot of resistance to reading about it, to thinking about it, because it's so scary, and because it's, you just want to hide your head in the ground or whatever. And it's hard to even wrap our heads around something that huge, that's so different from, you know, the world we have been familiar with. It's so different and unfamiliar. So, you know, I always thought that fiction was a good way to kind of approach that topic. And actually, kind of echoing what Brenda just said, when I was working on the novel All the Birds of the Sky, which is kind of about this dichotomy between, you know, this, it's about a mad scientist and a witch, and so it's about the dichotomy between tech and nature, kind of, in some ways, and trying to kind of show how that is a false binary and how those kinds of oppositions are always kind of misleading and kind of, you know, unreal. And so I just sort of got really fascinated by thinking about, like, how, you know, if you can have, you know, how can this mad scientist and this witch coexist, and really how can we have technology without destroying our own habitat, and how do we reconcile ourselves to actually being part of nature instead of being apart from nature? And thinking about climate change just naturally kind of flowed out of that. And it just, you know, when you write about the world we live in, like when you write about real life, climate change is going to be a part of that if you're paying any kind of attention to the world around us. It's not something that you have to go looking for. It's something that is, especially now, it's knocking on our door. It's out there. There's freaking forest fires and, you know, huge natural disasters everywhere. So it's not like you have to go looking for it.
But you've also written recently about how we need science fiction to help us think about climate change. So there's a kind of way in which we're, in writing about it, reflecting the world, reflecting on our own experiences in the world. But you also feel, I think, that there's some almost public duty to use the tools that we have as writers to help illustrate, explore, explain what is happening around us. Could you maybe talk a little bit about how you see those obligations as you feel them, and why you think it's so important for writers who write in these areas to be, you know, addressing climate change?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so I wrote a thing recently that caused a lot of stir called Science Fiction Writers Need to Be Writing About Climate Change Right Now. And I also wrote another thing, like, for the Washington Post about how I feel like science fiction gives us this toolkit. And I think maybe, I mean, I got some flack for saying that it's an obligation. I don't know if it's an obligation so much as it's an opportunity. It's an amazing opportunity. Science fiction provides a set of tools for imagining how the world will or could change. Science fiction is in some ways the literature of change. It's also the literature of problem solving. And so science fiction provides us with a way to kind of model how climate change is going to affect all of us, and also to think about how we can respond to climate change and how we can try to, you know, mitigate it and hopefully, you know, avoid the worst case scenario of climate change. Anyway.
Brenda, do you feel any of that kind of sense of obligation or pull of advocacy, or are you responding more privately to the subject?
There's no more private. But I think that it's really, the reason why no one wants to talk about climate change is because we have to deal with capitalism. Right. You know, we can't, I'm not like criticizing your bottle of water. Yeah. Sorry. But nobody wants to deal with that, you know? It's hard to remember that, like, all of our technology is oil.
Right.
You know? I mean, it's like, it's not like, let's stop publishing books because they use the trees. It's like, also our technology is, as you said, in a sort of binary with nature, because we're using our resources to make tech.
Yeah.
And everyone's buying it. You know, how do we get us to stop buying shit?
Sorry, quick interjection. I was on a panel like a week or so ago with an Australian person named Kat Sparks, who just got a PhD in science fiction and climate change. And she doesn't call it the Anthropocene. She calls it the capital scene. You know, because she, or the capitalist scene, I guess. Because this is the era that is where humans are shaping the world through capitalism. And capitalism is kind of the most important part of that. That is the engine of destruction.
Yeah, it's a run. Yeah. It's a total runaway horse.
And how would you explain how that thread plays through the Octopus Museum?
It's definitely there.
No, I know. It's just that, how do I say it in a way that's not just a total ramble? As a poet, I tend to not think as linearly as I would like when I'm speaking in public, because there's often sort of like more of a cluster thoughts. But I don't want to come off as hypocritical. It's like, buy my book. but the truth is that, you know, I think that it's that denial is tremendous, and I feel like as poets, you know, I love that you defined what science fiction can do. I love this idea that it's, you know, the language of what did you say? Two awesome things.
Oh,
opportunity and.
Yeah.
Problem solving, yeah. And I feel like poetry is a way that we imagine new worlds,
yes.
You know, and also sort of query and interrogate language to say, how are we saying things? Let's be careful about how we say things. And it could all feel quite hermetic and like it's not really doing anything. But I do feel like in many ways it is an anti-capitalism mode. It seems like actually talking to each other. Actually having people in a room together. I know we all took cars and trains and stuff to get here, but I mean, now we're here and we're talking. And actually sort of this, like, communication, that's what poetry is. It's just, these are my ideas. Will you listen to them? And then you tell me your ideas, and let's talk about what we're thinking, what we're feeling, and then in that, making new ways of thinking, new ways of feeling. I believe in that. And basically, I just want us to have a chance to do it more. In this book, I imagined that we had destroyed the world and destroyed the oceans and had this strange little fit of guilt about that. So we built these sort of salinization pods for octopuses because we ruined their ocean. And then they came on land and then kind of took over the grid because they have decentralized nervous systems. And so they could do that very easily. And so then they sort of took over the human race. And now we have these octopus overlords and we are working for them is what this book is about. And wow. It's kind of like, that's the second worst case scenario. So, yeah.
It's interesting that, you know, because you said you think of yourself as a poet who has sort of flashes of insight, but it's actually, especially as you described it just then, an incredibly narrative setup for a poetic project to have.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, it's all in prose poetry. It's all in prose, which someone asked me about it before, like, why do you have these big old prosy lines, like prose lines? What happened to your, you know, line breaks and your stanzas? And it's like, in the future, we're not going to be wasting our paper like that. So you have to use the whole page, you know? It is more narrative.
Yeah. Wow. Kai, how do you think of these issues?
Okay, well, one thing I think is, you know, as a novelist, an idea comes to me in a very, it's a kernel of something that I don't really understand when I set out. And it doesn't usually have any fully blown structure, and it doesn't even have an aboutness to it when it begins. And I kind of feel my way into it. But And I think that this is true for a lot of writers, what bubbles up is what is on your mind. It's the landscape of your mind. So if you find your way to writing about climate change because that is what you're kind of obsessed with. And since I've written this book, Weather Woman, I've been asked a lot, okay, so you've been writing about climate change. What do you, I mean, this young group of graduate students at CUNY came to me and they had this website and they wanted me to interview me, and their one of the big questions was, so what can we do about it? And I thought, oh man, this is really not my métier. I just don't know what to say. I mean, I felt really bad, like, here I am writing about it, but I can't recommend any particular actions. Mm-hmm. Well, I did it in the end. But one of the things it gave me...
What was your tip?
I'll get to that in a minute. But one of the things, I mean, and this is, it gave me a little platform for thinking really seriously about the value of writing about anything. In particular, we're talking about climate change. What does it mean to write about climate change? Does it really have any impact on any behavior anywhere? And I really grappled with this a lot since that particular interview, although I'd been grappling with it before. And I had this kind of aha moment, actually, because at an event, this guy came up and he was buying the book for his daughter, and he was really wanting to have conversations with her. He was not wanting to take her too far afield for her soccer games because of the fuel issue, and he was really grappling with all these issues. And I don't know why that particular interaction gave me this aha, but it was like, okay, the more you write about a particular thing, and a lot of people write about it, the more the conversation is on the table. And then the more people are talking about something, we know what that leads to. It leads to things like Me Too, it leads to whatever. It's then action happens. So I finally began to think, yeah, there is some purpose to this. I mean, I'm just a little cog here, but I'm part of a larger thing where we're all writing about climate change, and it is entering the conversation. And I was really pleased to see in the New Yorker, Bill McKibben wrote something saying he felt like that we were at a real tipping point. And I think that's kind of true. And so, anyway, write about climate change.
Well, it's interesting. It connects to something Charlie was saying earlier, which is, at least I've, you know, I'm a nonfiction writer, but I've seen over the last couple of years actually a lot more interest in stories about climate change, especially ones that really sketch out in detail what's coming. I think there's been, in addition to the change in the sort of political environment, a real change in the storytelling culture mm-hmm. around climate change. But I wonder, I'm curious what all of you think about this. I wonder, you know, this is a subject that has long been considered the province of science fiction, fantasy, and what it means to be writing about it now at a time when those, when reality has become so much more fantastical and so far from our, all of our baselines of expectation and experience. Is it still science fiction to write a novel about dramatic climate change, or is it now another form, and do we need a new name for it?
Interesting. Oh, that's a good question. You go, Charlie.
I mean, I think that, I mean, when you talk about genres, genres are primarily, what I always say is that genres are primarily geared towards, if you liked this book, you'll like this other book. Like, a bunch of people really liked Lord of the Rings, and so a bunch of other people started writing books that were like Lord of the Rings, and eventually we got fantasy books, and, you know, so on and so forth. I don't really care. I think that, to the extent that, you know, I think that climate, to the extent that genre boundaries matter, I think climate change transcends them, or kind of, transcend is a weird word, climate change kind of permeates through genres. I don't think that there's any particular genre that has a monopoly of writing about climate change. I think if you're writing about, you know, 20 years from now and the possible effects of climate change, that's still technically science fiction because you're using the science of what people predict is going to happen to write about, you know, a plausible future. But, you know, if you're writing about a story set in the present day in which, you know, either it's about climate change or climate change is a part of the story in some way or it's in the background. Like, what I always say to people is it doesn't have to be what the story is about. It can just be something that's in the background of the story, just like a bunch of other stuff, like just like random details of the world we're living in make it their way into the story in some form or another. There can just be a thing of like, oh, my flight was canceled because of all this terrible weather. Oh, there's wildfires and there's smoke in the air again. Oh, you know, it's not, it doesn't have to be the centerpiece. But I think, you know, I think realistic quote-unquote fiction set in the here and now can be doing more and probably should be doing more to include climate change as just one of the things that is part of being alive today, kind of. And it shouldn't be this, like, special thing where, like, I'm going to write about climate change. And it's like, you know, that's like a huge, like, I'm picking up this giant boulder. I'm like, nope, it's just something that you can sprinkle in. It's something that, you know, anybody can include, even if it's not the point of the story. And that's something I keep kind of pointing out to people. Anyway, that was a long-winded answer.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe the boulder of that narrative is so big that it's hard to even, if you're trying to lift it up, all, you know, it's hard to actually tell a story that
if you're like, I'm going to make a statement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that boulder didn't seem as effective, actually, as a metaphor as the sprinkling in. I was really imagining like a little heck of a Splenda in your story. You know, it's like a little climate change in the story. I also think, too, that the way that the right wing has tried to delegitimize the science behind what's happening is something that I think has silenced a lot of people on it. One thinks, if I'm not a total scientific expert, then I shouldn't say anything about anything because I don't want the right wing to say that it's all fake. God forbid I might like say something fantastical or something interesting that's actually creative. Then they have this way they can just say it's all bullshit because, you know, even the poets are writing about it now. But like, yeah, but to be able to sort of say, let's all talk about it all the time in every way without having to center it as, you know, the only, as the main topic, it seems radical to me. You know, because I do think that the right wing does really want to put this in a corner and keep it over there where no one looks at it. And we can't let them do that.
Right. Yeah, they want to
silence. I think that issue of what it means to scientists to reckon with this and then move into activism is interesting also. Because I've watched this guy that I did research with on Weather Woman, and he, you know, he's been... he's a glaciologist and climate scientist, and he's been researching dark snow on Greenland and various other things, the ice sheet in Greenland in general. And he has become extremely upset and has been gradually making forays into actually taking action, you know, writing not just for the scientific community, but writing for the lay public, making videos of his young daughter on Greenland, various things like this that are really forays into a kind of activism. And it's, I think that's just what you were talking about. The more we all own it, We can talk about it, even though we don't know as much as right now David does. But we know enough, and we know it's happening, and we all have immediate, intense experience with climate change. We've all been through extreme weather at this point. I mean, I can't, you know, droughts or fires or, I mean, I know so many people who have had to evacuate from fires in either California or Oregon. Many people who have had experienced floods back east or in Houston, or a recent faculty member at the University of Oregon came to Oregon because he wanted to move from Houston where he felt like he was going to be flooded. I mean, just we all, how many stories do we have? We all need to own those as a kind of authority that we have, I think, and use that.
Yeah, I think even those of us who haven't been directly impacted, all of us have had our sense of the future and what we expect to be coming changed so profoundly. Yeah. And our imaginations, our, you know, what we think the lives of our loved ones will be like down the line. Charlie, I was interested, you know, in your the riff you had about, you know, and the Splenda sprinkling. because I think there has been a kind of... you know, Amitav Ghosh writes about the difficulties that climate change poses for storytelling, and that it's such a big, complicated story that doesn't have protagonists in the way that we're used to traditional Western bourgeois novels having. And I think you're absolutely right that, you know, we have to figure out ways of telling the story that aren't straight ahead right at the subject. But I wonder if, you know, from a sort of technical narrative point of view, each of you might talk a little bit about how you've chosen to approach the subject in a novel way. If there were writers who, not to, you know, name names, but writers in the past who you felt were writing about climate in unproductive ways, and new strategies that you felt you developed in order to take a new approach and illuminate new parts of the story.
Well, so first of all, Amitav Ghosh has come in for a lot of flack for that article he wrote, because he didn't seem to have read a lot of people writing about science about climate change. Like, he seemed like he had just kind of skipped over a whole bunch of really amazing fiction, partly because a lot of it was published under the heading of science fiction rather than literary fiction, and I don't know. But I was literally just talking to somebody about how a lot of us were really unhappy with that article. I think that, you know, I mean, I don't know if Kim Stanley Robinson is in here. I saw him a little while ago, but his stuff, his writing about climate change is incredible. He has done it more than anybody to, you know, raise awareness of it and to depict it in really compelling and, you know, meaningful ways. In terms of my own work, I mean, I've, like in All the Birds in the Sky, I feel like part of what I play with in that book is this kind of sense that a lot of us have nowadays, that we're kind of low-key doomed, you know, that things are gonna fall apart. I think at some point, I can't remember if it's in the book or not, or if I cut that out, but there's one character who says, we built multiple unsustainable systems on top of each other, and we're lucky if they don't all fail at once, basically, because our economy is largely unsustainable. Our environmental practices are also unsustainable. Our farming practices are unsustainable. Like, there's all these unsustainable systems that we're just like sitting on top of, like, oh, it's fine, it's totally fine. Actually, you know, I think that I always say this, but that cartoon of the dog with the hat, with a little mug of that burning house, you know, who he's like saying, this is fine. I feel like that cartoon sums up so much about the world we're living in right now. And, you know, I feel like we all need to just be trying to wake that dog the fuck up all the time. But yeah, I think that, you know, I'm going to mention another thing that I actually a much maligned work that I feel like actually probably did do some good was James Cameron's Avatar, a movie that was seen by probably vastly more people than ever saw An Inconvenient Truth. And Avatar has a really strong environmentalist message, despite having a lot of issues. And I think that, you know, it's stuff like that actually does make a difference.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the power of art, being one panel cartoon, you think encapsulates the entire the entire crisis. That's amazing.
I mean, it says a lot about the world we're living in right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. But that's such a how powerful. Like, that person is probably just, I don't know, just a bunch of, markers.
Yeah,
it's not
even,
it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be that good a drawer to even make that statement, right? I really, I thought that Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11 was a novel, and it was really amazing, and I took tremendous inspiration from that novel for this book, because I really just loved her vision of, what happens when we're sort of just living on off the land again. And I did think, I feel terrible saying this in a public forum, but I thought it was a little bit of a cop-out that the reason why that happened was from a pandemic and not from climate change. It just seemed sort of like, all right, so that's just like a random virus that killed everybody and not that we destroyed it. It seemed like a little bit like letting humans off the hook.
So that virus could have been generated from...
It's true, but the point was really that it wasn't that we had done it. It was like it happened to us, and it's sort of like we need to take more of the blame for that. But her... Yeah, sort of some of the ways that she sort of puts in language, and one of my favorite images from that is the horse only had half a tail because the cellist had to restring her bow.
Huh.
And like that kind of image really sticks with you.
Yeah.
And it might actually make you write a whole new it's an entry into a world that then sort of opens up, and then you write your own way into that new world. But the other thing I wanted to say was that it's the low key doom. What was that? Is that you said low key?
We're feeling low key doomed.
It's like it's really easy to be like, oh, we're fucked. That's it. Screw it.
It's
a lot harder to actually figure out. That's harder homework assignment, right?
Yeah.
How do we?
Yeah. I always say that despair is like a snuggly blanket. Despair is super cozy. It's a warm pair of slippers.
Right. I'm trying to go back to your original question and remember about the unique ways we appreciate it.
No need.
Saying either, but I was thinking of it. okay, one thing that I wanted to get to in this recent novel and in the next one as well, is the idea that you can feel more disturbed about climate change and more likely to take action if you're really attuned to nature and the earth in a kind of an elemental way. And, there are so many things in our lives, and I think you refer to this in your book also, that remove us from the earth, remove us from the climate. I mean, just the houses we live in that are, you can easily be in a high apartment building and hardly ever feel the air on you and whatnot. And, the streets that remove you from your feet on the earth, your feet on the ground. Many people don't have much access to seeing things grow or seeing animals, the wild animals. I mean, I live in Eugene, Oregon, and we do see a lot of wild animals. Turkeys are coming now down into our streets, and a deer are come right up to our windows. And I mean, not in a good way, actually. But but so I wanted to write about a character who was truly attuned to the earth and the wild things in it. And I felt like that was sort of a precursor to having the inclination to save the earth in a way. And then at some point when I was writing the book, I mean, this is the second thing that I think is like a little, I was trying to get in there. Nobody can do it alone. I mean, there are so many people around my town that are like really avid recyclers, and they ride their bikes, and they're doing all the right things. But that won't do it. Even if everybody in this room and everybody in Berkeley and everybody, it's not enough. There has to be political action. There has to be legislation. So I was trying to, at the end of my book, it's just maybe sort of dumb as I describe it, but she's in the Arctic trying to refreeze the permafrost,
And she's kind of having, she's losing it and freezing, and a white fox comes along and says, where are your people? You know, meaning like, you guys got to get it together and do this together. You can't do this alone. But but you know, I was writing that book for a long time before I realized that I needed to go there with it. You know, it took me a while. That, you know, I wasn't interested in the idea of a super heroine who did it all herself, like, you know, like the superheroes we know from movies. That's not what my book is, but
but that's another challenge for writing about the subject, is how to dramatize collective action and political action, because, you know, it's sort of easier to write stories that do draw you into low-key doom, or the, you know, the blanket of despair. But something that illustrates the power of collective action, I'm maybe just speaking for myself, but it's always seemed a lot harder to do well. Is that something that you've reckoned with, wrestled with? Or maybe you want to talk about how you came to that part of the that part of your book.
Well, it just suddenly seemed this character had done a series of kind of, we'll call them rescue missions, putting out fires and tornadoes and various things, and of course, you know, it's all Band-Aid work, and if she's the only one who can do it, that's a problem. You know, how much can you? It's kind of like, okay, we can do some carbon capture here, but what about, you know, all the other places it's happening? You can't think that way. You have to think more more globally. And it just became clear to me that I thought, wait, this is not a solution. I mean, it was weird, because it was like I felt like I was recreating the whole problem again with what she did to address it, and then realizing, no, this doesn't address it. I don't know if that makes sense, but so I felt like I went through this little epiphany as I was writing the novel. But I do think it's really hard. I'm racking my brain to try to think of some novels that do depict collective action really in an interesting way. I don't know if maybe people out there in the audience can think of some. But
well, in your case, the protagonist, the hero, is, I mean, a person with some special powers too. It's not just a kind of politically engaged person, but
right. She's
a superhero in a certain way.
Yeah, right.
So, like, we're not going to get an Aria to come save us from this. That's not going to happen.
Spoiler alert.
I don't know. When it comes to the collective, like, you know, that's what's so terrifying about this. You know,
you can say
I'm doing everything, and that's not enough. And then you can see how evil that could get when you're just like, hey, neighbor, I see you didn't compost your XYZ. You can see how it suddenly turned into something else entirely. But I go back to that same definition of community where we have to listen to each other. You know, when the presidential election happened, and I found myself teaching my students, and I had undergraduates and graduate students, and they were all looking at me like, what do we do now? And I'm like, fuck. How do I look them in the eye? And then finally, I just sort of, I got down off of my sort of professor stance, and I said, what do you think? What should we do? And they had the best ideas.
Oh, good.
You know, they're like, okay, we're going to start stockpiling plan B. We're going to start, you know, like, they were just like, we're all going to not go to class next presidential election. We're going to sort of caravan down to Pennsylvania next time and not sit in our class in New Jersey, which we know is going to go blue. You know, like, they had these great ideas, and they gave me so much hope. I just thought, like, it's not just joining a march or sort of trying to vote, you know, in the ways that we were hoping it'll go, but it's also sort of just like hearing new ideas, trying to see what else might fly. Let's see if we can sort of make it happen. I don't know. I feel incredibly lonely when I'm just mail ordering my fish antibiotics. Has anyone done that prepper stuff? You're like, people were nervously laughing, like, you know about that? my husband was like, you did what? But yeah, you can get these fish antibiotics for the, you know, for the apocalypse.
Well, you feed them to fish, or
no,
you eat them
no.
before you eat
They're
fish?
They're available as fish antibiotics. Uh-huh. You can't stockpile antibiotics.
They're prescription only, and
fish ones are not. But, you know, that's an incredibly lonely situation. And also, but then again, who among us has actually said, like, I'm never taking a international flight again? I mean, I haven't gotten there. So it needs to be sort of, I don't know what the sort of, you know, larger movement could be if we really can't change everything.
Well, I mean, we can change things if we legislate. I mean, if somebody says plastic bottles are no longer, they're going to be made or used by anyone.
What's that going to take, though? Like, how is that going to, how are we going to do that?
Huge political will.
Just will? Just.
Yeah.
But I think.
How are we going to make them do it? They're not going to do it. This is like their cash cow.
No, I mean, I do feel like we're getting there where the will is almost, is congealing, should we say.
I don't know, I'm still hoping for Aria or Greta Thunberg.
Yeah.
Someone.
So building off of what Brenda and Kai just said, I mean, I've been thinking a lot in my writing the last few years about writing about communities, and particularly, like, in speculative fiction, we talk a lot about world building, and, like, we talk about creating worlds that feel real, that you could go and live in and stuff. And I increasingly think that the key to good world creation is thinking about communities and thinking about not just the individual against this backdrop of, like, you know, the place that they live or whatever, and, like, a handful of characters against, like, a painted backdrop, but, like, a real sense of, like, the community that somebody belongs to and the ties that they have to other people and the things that bring people together. And I think a lot in my fiction about how people can have more connections with each other and more understanding of each other, because I think that is crucial. And I think that that's crucial politically, but also just in terms of our ability to take collective action and address these collective problems. And I think that, you know, individualism is kind of, it's kind of been done to death, and it's a little bit of a disease in among Americans, I think, in particular. Like, our obsession with individualism is part of how we got here. You know, our obsession with everybody has to have their own car and everybody has to have their own kind of, you know, separate, like, fortress that we all live in is part of how we got into this mess in the first place. So I think, you know, I mean, I like alone time too, but I think thinking about how people can have more robust ties with each other and more real connections to other human beings is really important. And
it also just makes for better stories.
Right? Yeah, and I've thought a lot about how to tell, you know, stories that are kind of, in a sense, like a love story of a whole community. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the origin story of a community, the story of, like, a community falling in love with each other and what that looks like. And that's something I've been kind of noodling on a little bit, because I think it's important.
And expanding those communities beyond the sort of small tribes that we live with, right?
You know, right.
Yeah.
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 Well, I think maybe it's time for some audience Q&A. I think we've got a mic that can be passed around to those who have questions. Oh, if you guys want to line up on the side, sorry. And yeah, please, you know, as always, try to actually ask a question.
Yeah.
You had to be.
I'm curious if any of you written, I'm not familiar with your works. Has anybody written or entertained writing about what I think, sorry not to make a comment, but about the root element here is overpopulation of the human species. Has anybody considered that as in
about
your writings?
Overpopulation?
They did in the 1970s. It was very popular in the 1970s, and it was a big thing back then. That's where the movie Silent Green comes from. I think that nobody really thinks about that the same way now.
One thing, though, I think about a lot is that I do think one of the reasons for this sort of totalitarianism sweeping the world, and, you know, this terrible fear of immigrants in this country and in other places as well, it has to do with some kind of underlying sense of scarcity approaching. And that scarcity has to do with, of course, climate change, where there probably will be food shortages and there will be mass migrations from, you know, climate change migrations. And so the notion of scarcity, it needs to be addressed in some way for people to change behavior, I think. Because, you know, when people fear they're not going to have enough, then they get grasping. And I don't think anybody has addressed the fact that some of this has to do with the population of the Earth growing to such a point that the Earth is going to be it will be unsustainable, especially given a drier and less fertile Earth.
Population growth is already slowing down, though, and it's slowing down drastically in the developed world. And we should open our doors. We should open the floodgates. We should let in everybody who wants to come here.
I totally agree.
Stories about overpopulation always turn into stories about eugenics in the end, or at least they often do. And there's a lot of implied racism in narratives about overpopulation. So I think that there's been a move away from that towards thinking about how we can accommodate everybody and take care of the whole human race.
I don't disagree with any of that. And there wasn't a subtext of racism or eugenics. But in the sheer total number and the burden on the planet is my point. And I think there are lots of aspects to that that could be covered in fictional writing. Mm. And one is just our ability or inability, what I think is our inability to really limit our own lives when the time comes. And if I was presented with a choice of either having some kind of medical procedure or the end of life, which was what nature would have defined for me, I can't choose to go with nature. I don't have that ability. I don't think we have that ability very well to regulate ourselves, not talking about racism or immigration kind of an issue, but in a personal level. Does that make sense?
Well, I have a lot of plan B, so.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you. Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if any of the panelists know about climate change fiction that addresses it as kind of an economic threat, because maybe that's the way to strike at the heart of a capitalist. Because, if you think about 2008, it shows a tight interrelationship between the strength of the economy, the banking system, and the value of real estate. So what happens if, there's $1 trillion worth of real estate that's permanently underwater? And what does that do to the strength of the economy?
There are estimates that by the end of the century, if we don't change course, there will be climate damages totaling as much as $600 trillion, which is twice as much as all the wealth that exists in the world today. So this is, likely part of our future.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about people who, in the middle of a huge, obvious housing bubble, insisted that it was fine and that we could just keep selling subprime loans forever. Mm-hmm. I think long-term thinking and capitalism don't necessarily go together.
But I think your point is really well taken. That's just an important thing. It would be good to get that consciousness in our work.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi. Thanks. Great panel. I'm wondering if... So this connects back to this idea of sort of the systems that are in place being unsustainable and needing to collapse. But, like you said, Brenda, that, we're not all stopping to take international flights. And connecting back to something Charlie said about science fiction being the literature of the possible, I was wondering if you can either think of anything that you've read recently that has sort of addressed climate change, not from a dystopia, but from a problem-solving perspective, from a utopian view of how maybe do we change fuel systems so that we were making less of a negative impact? How did we change things? As bad as capitalism can be, it's a very difficult thing to fight. And as much as we want it to change, it's so deeply rooted into our culture that maybe the best way to do it is through some kind of capitalistic endeavor. It's a horrible thing to say. I don't know, but... How do you beat them by using their tools against them?
Huh? Yeah.
I have some thoughts, but you should go. No. Well, so we're in Berkeley, which was the home of Ernest Kallenbach, who wrote the great book Ecotopia. I was lucky enough to meet him when he was still around, and that book is amazing in terms of imagining a future of a post-capitalist future where we are actually using resources wisely. But I think I'm going to bring back Kim Stanley Robinson, who I think has written some great stuff about coping with climate change. And I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I just reacted like this because I love what you were saying. I mean, can we make, maybe if things can be more profitable for, you know, those evil capitalists over there who just want their wallets to fatten, like, can we make it so that there's, you know, pods we all live in that make them money too, you know, but also, like, filters our air or whatever.
Do you know of any such books?
Well, I've read books that feature interesting ideas about it, but nothing that really addresses it as a central premise, you know? Yeah. Nothing that is taking on the question of climate change from the perspective of, like, fixing it while still allowing people to travel internationally or wear T-shirts.
I hope you
write
that.
So are you charging us with that?
I don't know. It would be sweet. Think about it. I'll buy it.
I consider it a charge.
There is a brand new genre called solarpunk that people are just starting that's basically stories about, you know, alternative energy and creating more sustainable systems. And I'm seeing more of that coming out now,
nice.
Which is exciting.
Cool. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, okay. She has the mic. I was wondering if you've thought about unintended consequences through perhaps misguided technological solutions to any of this. And I'm thinking about, like, in the realm of biology, how scientists have, mistakenly introduced organisms into an ecosystem only to have it completely backfire, and what that might mean, you know, in terms of trying to mitigate climate change.
I'm just going to say that this is something I worry a lot about, that we're going to be up against sort of final hours or whatever before total decimation, and people are going to decide to seed the stratosphere with aerosols that will block the sun, and then, I mean, I think that this can be so easily really wreak havoc, and I worry about it. I don't know what to say about it, but I worry about it.
Yeah, there was just, I think in last week's Economist, there was a piece that basically said that that approach, they called it inevitable, which gets back to everything else we've been talking about capitalism. This is something we haven't really studied much in depth, and yet many quite powerful people are now treating it as a kind of inevitability.
Yeah. I mean, that's the one, one that scares me the most, although I think there are other versions of that, you know.
I mean, that's the movie Snowpiercer in a nutshell, basically.
Yeah. That's the so. Now we're going to that dismal place, aren't we?
Snowpiercer? Okay.
Yeah, it's Snowpiercer is an amazing film. You should watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for being here. And I did want to just suggest that Kim Stanley Robinson's New York 2140, I think, is something that does take on capitalism in the context of a climate-changed world and also does address collective action in a way. So that's something people should look for. I enjoyed that book. My question is, you know, when I think, there are a lot of things I think about when I think about things that have to change in our world as we go forward and hope to mitigate climate change. And one of which is, like, sports in a way, like can we really like have cars driving around in the circle for hours on end?
It's a good metaphor.
You know? But what about like the Warriors flying to Boston to play the Celtics all the time, you know? And I'm wondering if you know of anyone and you're like, have you ever imagined a professional sports modified world in the future? Do you know anyone who's writing stuff like that? And I'm just sort of curious about whether it's possible to get there and what it would look like.
Oh my God, that is so amazing. I feel like there are actually some solutions here in this room. Like, just ban all that, you know? But I actually did write a poem in this book about, like, instead of all the suburban kids playing soccer, they all had to play winter ball, and they have, like, totally jacked up, janky, like, equipment, because they don't, you know, it's in the future, and we ruined everything. But I feel like I have new hope. I love your idea of not, yeah.
So ban the NFL? I mean, I don't know.
Thank you.
was wondering, I've become very pissed off at dystopian sci-fi. I've noticed this massive gap of like humanitarian moral futurism. And when I think of climate change and what, in my opinion, we have to like unify as a world or die. And the difficult thing about the transition is how many things need to change simultaneously. For example, economically, whatever the next economic system is, its primary function should be to get us through this difficult period. So I was wondering, as writers, as an imaginary, as this is to the whole room, why not intentionally, interventionally, positively imagine the future? And just like, also a plug, anyone in here could write a policy that could change the world and offer it to an elected official. But the question is, like, why not just intentionally imagine the things that are most taboo in our collective psyche, like capitalism ending or the United States president saying, look, we fucked this up. The president of Exxon fucked, kind of like the Onion. And so I was wondering, you know, yeah, just like, it's comedic journalism, but it's pointing out what actually needs to happen. Anyway, so it's just kind of an open-ended comment question as a strategy as writers.
Again, that's a great charge to put that positive image out there is basically. Again, I take that one as a charge too.
Thank you.
Well, I'm writing about climate, but in a nonfiction way, but also have been an activist on climate off and on since 1981. And I just want to say I'm so grateful for the writing that you're doing, because when the arts and the writers and the poets start approaching issues that we're challenged by, that's when people really listen. I mean, a fact sheet can only go so far, and I've written a lot of those. But the kind of work that you're doing and how you're thinking about it is really important. And I just want to say this, what Armando was just saying about, and someone else also said about creating the positive vision, it's really, really important. And I had a question for you. Also, in terms of just to say on the positive side, when I came back to climate in 2006 here in the Bay Area, you could fit everybody who was working on it professionally around one conference table, and now you can get 40,000 people in the street. So we are making progress. But there is something for everyone to do. So there's, and whatever you want to do, and the arts are a great way to get it across. So I have a question, then just one more comment. You should know that Snowpiercer is coming back. The movie Neige Percée, it was French originally. It's coming back as a television series this summer, starring Berkeley High's very own David Diggs as the revolutionary leader. So look for that. I believe it'll be out this fall, but it's going to be astonishing. And beyond that, what is it, because I talk to writers and artists all the time to try and say, hey, you know, we need you. Where did the decision point come from you to say, hey, I need to write about this, and I need to create about this? And finally, just to say that one thing about legislation, you're absolutely right. We have to have lots of it, but it's really boring to write about what we do, those of us that work on it. So how can I'd be interested in you guys finding a interesting, intriguing way not only to write about positive futures, but also how to make the process of where we get there a little more intriguing, such that it's not quite so dull. So that's my challenge. Well, back to the first question. How did you decide to write about this issue? Where did you come to it?
I have a disabled child. My son Cal is 11, and he has severe cerebral palsy, and he doesn't walk or talk. And it really, over the past few years, I've had to really sort of, really just sort of accept that. You know, when he was born, I thought, like, oh, maybe he'll walk, maybe he'll walk. And then I'm like, you know, maybe he won't. And the way that he's so very dependent on technology and on the things that we have, sort of, you know, his wheelchair and his enteral tube and the plastics and the doctor's appointments and the grid, really, made me, I mean, that was really my entree. I realized, like, oh, we have to fight positively. We have to make change, because we can't just go out into the forest and, like, eat nuts, you know? Like, we have to actually work within the system and make it work. That's why I found myself letting myself think about the worst possible case scenarios, the worst fears I had, and writing about it in order to stop them from going off endlessly in my mind. But it was because I don't have the situation where I can just say, you know, fuck it, we'll just go, like, you know, build a boat and go live in the on the beach and, you know, catch fish. Like, we can't do that. Even if one wanted to, I'm a mom and I have this child that we have who's dependent on this system. And so for me, this system has to work. Not the capitalist right. system. I mean, the like the fact that we you know, that he has doctor's appointments, that we can, you know, use tubing for his, you know, for his feedings, that he has a way in and out of the world. No, we don't need gasoline necessarily, but like if we ever want to go anywhere with him, we do.
Or something that works like it.
Yeah. Something that works like, or yeah, I'm yeah. not, yeah, yeah, definitely.
I think that's so true. As soon as you have a child, and many people right. in this room I'm sure do, I mean, you think about the whole issue very differently. And I just wanted to put in a plug for a positive, a book with a very positive approach, which is called Climate Revolution by Mary DeMocker. And it's about, it's trying to help parents teach their children about climate change and various activities you can do. And it's a very good book and has been getting a lot of press and high recommendations, including from Bill McKibben. Anyway, if you are a parent and want to teach your kids, this might be a book to invest in. Or if you're anyone, just it's called Climate Revolution. Yeah.
Thanks.
Hi. So as you know, each of us can make a difference in terms of our energy use, you know, heating, cooling our homes, lighting, plug loads. And as you probably know, air conditioning is probably one of the most intensive ways it's mostly energy intensive use of energy. But those are really mundane things. And how would artists such as yourself who want to give people ideas or inspire them to take action, incorporate mundane ways such as that? And then second question, have any of you read The Wall by John Lanchester?
No. I have, it's good.
Cool. I haven't read it.
You have read it?
I haven't, no.
That sounds
great. Yeah. I mean, in terms of how to inspire people, I think that, you know, as we've been discussing on this panel, what's really needed is collective action and really collective political action to make a massive change at the national and international level. And I think, you know, I would encourage people to read books like L.A. Kaufman's How to Read a Protest. And what was her book before that? I think it was called Collective Action. And think about how we can actually get out in the streets and
sorry, I do think I think policy is important. I really do. And I think politicians can play a role. But I think also on an individual level, too.
I mean, you know, I'm not really part of the panel, but from my perspective, you know, in order for the planet's climate to be stabilized, we need not just to reduce our emissions, we need to zero them out in relatively short order. And I think it's basically impossible to imagine that happening through individual action. You can only achieve it through political action. And I think there is value in individual action in the sense that we can advertise that life can still be fulfilling and prosperous while still being more responsible, but it's only a way station to the kind of policy changes that we need to really stabilize things.
Nancy Pelosi's office in San Francisco should have people sitting in it every day. There should be people blocking the door to Nancy Pelosi's office. Not picking on her personally, but she's local and she's got a lot of influence over this.
Yeah, she is.
So first, as someone with life-threatening food allergies, I for real can't go to the forest to eat nuts. So I greatly appreciate that take on things. And then also, I am a student. I'm at Berkeley City College. I'm going to be at Cal in the fall, which is very exciting. And thank you. And I'm going to be a geography major, hoping to go into climate change, and I'm also an aspiring writer, and I'm trying to think about my future and how I can merge my interests to do the most good. So to that point, I was wondering how y'all think about your roles as science communicators through fiction or nonfiction, because I know you must do a lot of research for your stories. So, yeah.
And poems.
Right. I just wanted to say that, you know, you're our future. Like, I'm so glad that you're doing all the, like, those are your interests. Thank God someone's doing it. But I don't have anything else to say about it. No, I don't.
No. I've done a lot of research for these couple of books that I have just written, and I think, you know, there's nothing more valuable than really well-written science, if you can write it. And, because I, a layperson, was trying to read all this science, and I appreciated the things that were really, really written well and made it possible for me to comprehend them pretty easily. So I think there's a huge, huge need for that, especially in this arena.
Yeah, I've been really thrilled and surprised to find that, you know, scientists don't mind being bugged. Like, when you email out of the blue or even phone out of the blue and say, hey, I'm writing a story about blah, and I saw your paper that you wrote, and ideally you've actually read the paper before you bug this person. I was wondering if you could talk to me about some of this stuff in your paper. People generally are happy to talk to authors, like fiction writers, way more than I had expected. And, you know, because A, they like geeking out about this stuff. They like to educate people. That's why they're here. And, like, they like to kind of have an excuse to kind of speculate a little bit, which they don't get to do normally. But also, B, it's from their perspective, you know, they'd rather set the author straight, you know, and have the science be right in the story and have that one conversation, then have like 100 conversations afterwards with people who are like, oh, I read this book where it said that, you know, the world would turn backwards and birds would be flying sideways and, like, you know, I saw this Roland Emmerich movie or whatever. I don't know. You know, they would way rather have it get it right in the first place than have to deal with all the misconceptions and misunderstandings that you're going to spread for years afterwards if you don't get it right. So, you know, I think it's really important to try to do your homework, and, like, obviously there's always going to be a little bit of BS in any fictional narrative, but try to do your homework, and, you know, scientists are really there for that. And, like, scientists are, you know, I've been just so grateful to the scientists that I've been able to work with on my stories.
And just on the sort of professional, personal advice front, I mean, from my perspective, and I think everybody on this panel is an illustration of this, this story is just so big that there's not one way to attack it. There's not one career to take to approach it. Absolutely. If you are motivated by climate change, you can follow that path through 1,000 different areas, from, you know, directly into politics to, you know, storytelling and poetry to, you know, journalism, but there are a million other ways. Mm-hmm. Being an educator, being a community organizer, but I mean, really, it's so big that there's no aspect of contemporary life that's untouched by it, and that means that there's no future path for you that you can't address climate change by following if you feel compelled to move that way.
Cool. And also, real quick, Charlie Jane Anders, is there going to be a sequel to The City in the Middle of the Night?
Sort of. I'm working on a short story right now that kind of follows up a couple of the characters, and I might write another book in that world at some point, but there's no immediate plans for a sequel.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
In Jenny O'Dell's recent book, How to Do Nothing, she refers to the monetization of our attention and the fragmenting of it in the capitalist economy, and she says, paraphrasing another philosopher, that it has limited us in how to want what we want to want, which I know is a little hard to follow. We were talking earlier about flights and how no one's really willing to stop taking international flights. The writer for Grist, Eric Holthaus, has not flown since 2013, and that doesn't come from thoughts that individual action is what's going to change anything. That doesn't come from any holier-than-thou attitude. For him, he writes from a position of great empathy. And I find that Eric Holthaus has shown me how to want in a world that may be more affected by climate change. I'm wondering for you all, including you, David, who is a character in fiction that you've either written or read that showed you how to want in a climate-centric way? I know you've mentioned...
I'll go first, I guess. So I wrote this... There's an anthology that came out a couple of years ago called Drowned Worlds or Drowned Cities, Drowned Worlds, that's basically about a post-flooding world, but post-climate change flooding, and it's a bunch of short stories by different authors. And I was really struggling with how to write about a world post-climate change, post-flooding that wasn't just like, you know, the road or whatever, you know, that wasn't just super depressing and awful. Until I kind of hit on this character who is like actually kind of optimistic and falls in love with this sort of community of misfits living in the flooded remains of San Francisco. And that kind of optimism and that feeling of like, we're going to make it, it's going to be rough, but we're going to make it, was something that I found was actually really freeing to write. I don't know.
I'm still struggling with an answer here. Do you want to speak? You've already, yeah.
I feel like I'm going to burst into tears. That's such a beautiful question.
I really
love it. I want to think about it, and I feel like it's a very precious question. I can't wait to get away from here and go back to my hotel room and think about it, because it really does seem like that's one of the most hopeful things you could ask, you know?
It's really
the heart.
It's all about listening and watching, right?
So thank you for that question.
That was so kind. Thank you.
Okay. I ask this with the caveat that obviously as part of the top 10% of the world, the United States has a very large role to play in trying to address climate change. But that said, do you know if this kind of conversation is happening among writers outside the U.S., outside of Europe, in the global south, in China, in parts of Africa, et cetera, and how do you connect those writings with the writing that's happening here to address climate change and getting the public to take it seriously?
You may know much about that. I don't know. I do know
some stuff about that. First of all, I love your John Picaccio t-shirt. That is so awesome. Worldcon. Second of all, you know, I know that there's a lot of conversations in China happening about this right now, because Chinese science fiction is like, that's where a lot of the best writing is happening right now, is actually in China. And there's one novel that literally just came out in the U.S. like 3 days ago in an English translation called Waste Tide by an author named Chen Xiaofan, which you should all read. It is one of the most amazing books I've read in the past few years. And it is about this Chinese village where they are dealing with horrible environmental consequences of basically like all this e-waste has been dumped in their village. And it's amazing. It's an incredible book. And it's kind of scary, but it's also just beautiful and awesome. And I feel like there's so much great stuff happening in China right now with trying to imagine climate change. And I know that, you know, I've been talking to some folks in Brazil recently who they're also trying to find ways to talk about it. So I think that this is definitely a conversation that's being had everywhere. And like, you know, it's a struggle everywhere.
I can't speak really specifically to it, but there's a novel that I'm looking forward to reading called Nighttime in Nuuk, I think it is, which Nuuk is in Greenland. And I haven't read it, but I would not be surprised if there were issues of climate change addressed in it, since in Greenland it's such a big issue. I mean, everywhere it is, but Greenland, you know, with the melting ice sheet and in particular.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm very nervous. So as an author and as a person, I'm really interested in this like strange, misguided drive to see Mars as some kind of savior option to save humanity, because of course this is how this is going to get fixed. And I was wondering if I could hear y'all's takes on that escapism drive. I know, Charlie, you, mild spoilers, kind of addressed this in All the Birds in the Sky, and I was wondering, like,
just go.
You explain.
I mean, it's sort of horrifying to me. I think it's especially striking that it's a fantasy that's been cooked up and is being enacted by some people who are incredibly rich, incredibly powerful, and want to see themselves as gods. And I just think you have this really great opportunity to do, like, to use those resources to play a godlike role and help us here. Why are you devoting your resources towards this form of escapism, which is really, I think, what it is? I honestly don't have a great answer or explanation. It doesn't make much sense to me. But I would say, I mean, as I think you surely know, you know, it's however horrible things get on Earth, it's going to be a lot easier for us to build a biodome here than it is going to be for us to make sustainable living possible on a place like Mars. So, yeah, it seems to me anyway to be a truly foolish waste of resources and, and priorities.
Yeah. I have nothing to add to what David said, except that those guys who are thinking about going, it's mostly guys. I
mean, yeah, totally.
Who are thinking about going to Mars are the ones who aren't building the bunkers underground for, you know, those elaborate bunkers that people have built. Anyway, you said it all.
Yeah, I mean, I very much support exploring the rest of the solar system. I very much support, you know, space exploration and, you know, maybe eventually trying to establish a presence off Earth. But I think where you run into trouble is thinking of it as an alternative to saving the only habitat that we have. And I think that people don't really appreciate how many ways we're only suited to this one kind of very specific habitat, like all the different ways ranging from atmospheric pressure to, you know, radiation, mm-hmm. to gravity, to just a ton of other stuff. There are so many ways in which Earth is like the perfect planet for us, and we are never, never going to find another planet that is even remotely in the same league in terms of like suitability for human life. So I think that, you know, maybe 1,000 years from now, we will figure out ways to colonize other planets that are sustainable. But I don't think it's going to be a short-term or even medium-term solution to the damage we're doing to this planet. Absolutely. And I think that is a destructive fantasy.
And just to pick up on one little thing that you said there, I mean, it's also, we're already living outside of the boundaries of temperature that have enclosed all of human history. So mm-hmm. while we grew up in this very particular habitat, we are actually already no longer living in that habitat.
Yeah. Hi, I too am quite nervous, but first of all, I want to thank all four of you because I used to read a lot of fiction, and then I kind of stopped for a long time, and your panel's really making me want to read fiction again, so
oh, cool.
Thank you.
Yay.
For that. And
I'm so glad.
I just wanted to offer a resource along the themes that have been coming up about positive visioning of the future, positive world building, and how to do that within the constructs of the kind of bizarre, bastardized, extreme form of capitalism that we have currently. So there's a wonderful podcast called Pitchfork Economics, and the last, most recent episode of it is on the economics of climate change. And I just put that out there as a offering for inspiration, both for narrative exploration and for taking action in the world that we live in today. So thank you, and I hope that everyone finds that useful.
Well, thank you, and thanks everybody for coming, and thanks to our great panel. It's a great conversation, and thanks again.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.